So the idea with the poultry, let me back up here and do a big picture thing. Big picture thing is one of the biggest problems we have right now in mainline agriculture is creating complementary holonic enterprises on an existing land base to create a salary for the next generation. Now that's a mouthful, but every one of those things was important. The age of the average American farmer is now about 60 years old. And one of the problems is that there is not enough resource base to expand the single mothership enterprise enough to incorporate the next generation in early enough in the operation. And so what farms tend to do is wait till dad and mom hit retirement age and don't need any income from the farm anymore, and then try to incorporate the kids, but that's about 15 years too late. The kids are now 15 years into their careers, and they're now up to paid vacations and 401k plans, and they've got a Roth and whatever, and they don't want to come back to the farm. So the time to pick that youthful enthusiasm is when the kids are 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, and they're starting to think about career and creating that opportunity while mom and dad are still in their late 40s. Are you with me? So I want to get that out of the way, because I think that is, you know, when I did the chickens, that wasn't what was crossing my mind. What was crossing my mind was how do I build enough income into this small farm to hire myself? Okay? And so that was what was going through my mind. It wasn't really multi-generational. It was just for me. Now I realize what an economic engine that is to create a salaried opportunity for the next generation, whether it's related or not related. That doesn't matter. The point is that we don't really have a business. Listen to me carefully. We don't have a business until we have a farm that can hire multi-generations on it. If all we can hire is one generation, then we don't have a succession plan. You with me? That's powerful. And that's where I think the poultry for us really filled that gap. For somebody else, it might be something else. You know, maybe it'll be an agritourism thing. Maybe it would be guided hunts. Maybe it will be guided hunts / recreational dinners on the grounds thing. Maybe it'll be corporate retreats at a lodge that you build with the bandsaw mill with free lumber that you build cheaper than anybody else because you've got a bandsaw mill that can take lumber. Are you with me? All right. So I don't know what those complementary things are, but I just know that as a business, it's very, if you're just, you know, take Wyoming, we'll take cattle, okay? If the only thing that this business can do is grow cattle, it puts an incredible land-based burden on the next generation to expand the cattle enough to get enough to create two salaries early enough so that this time lag doesn't happen. That's big picture. All right, so here's the Eggmobile. The Eggmobile follows the cows about 3 days because the fly cycle is 4 days. Those of you who read Stockman Grass Farmer know Alanation says one of the reasons that the big herds in nature move along, one of the things that keeps them moving, is the fly cycle. They don't want to stay in the same place very long. The flies hatch and push those wildebeests on to the next spot. All this is a trailer deal. They're hooked together simply because it's a lot easier to move two smaller ones than one great, great big one. I mean, you know, it's from going over dips and swales and through a creek or whatever, all right? The two give you a segmented deal. Here's the chicken ladder. They go up, and these are just bungee corded up And these doors can drop down. Then when we want to move them, we just drop, well, the chickens go in at night, and we just drop those down, and they're locked in, so we can pick the, we can, you know, hook up with the tractor and move them wherever we want to the next morning. Now, how do we train them? Well, number one, we don't put any chicken out here that's not laying. They need to be laying eggs in order to have enough of a nesting homing instinct to want to go to that thing. And so it's the egg, it's the desire to go to an egg nest that creates the draw to make them want to stay there. Now, what we do is we put them in, we lock them in, we put the 800 birds in there, 400 in an eggmobile, lock them in for 24 hours so they have to eat, drink, and lay an egg in there the first 24 hours. The next day, daybreak, we open the doors, let them out. Well, about 10 o'clock, and they have this urge to go lay an egg. Yesterday, they laid it up in there. What we want to do is to get them to go up and down that ladder two or three times the very first day, okay? That's why you lock them in the first day. They're not happy, but that's part of the disturbance of creating an educated chicken. Now, the key is that the first night that they're out there, we sit under there with a long stick, go out there about an hour before dark, and with preferably rain pants and rain gear, and sit under the eggmobile with a long stick and don't let them settle down under the eggmobile as it gets dark. They instinctively don't want to go out in the field because they know, oh, I'm vulnerable, you know, great horned owls, whatever's going to come along and pick me off. So they want to climb it, they want to, you know, go in there and settle down. We don't let them settle down. The first night we'll have to catch maybe a third of them. They just don't get it. Gets dark, and they finally settle down right under there. We just have to catch them and put them in. All right, the second night, catch maybe 5%. Third night, less than 1%. Fourth night, you're done. If you neglect to sit under there the very first night, it'll cost you a week of training. Yes? You could. You could. And you will find out why we don't. It's too difficult. I mean, it's too difficult to get this ladder. What they'll do is it gets dark, they'll just all stack up against that netting trying to go under there and break it down. In order to get it up hard enough so that they can't break it down as they start pushing against it, it's such a big job, you might as well just sit under there for an hour and be done with it. We've tried that, and it's more efficient. At least we feel like it's a lot more efficient to do this than it is to try to put that netting up and have it tight enough up under there, you know, where there's no holes, no gaps. You got the hitch to deal with, you got the ladders to deal with. You know, there's a lot of stuff there to deal with. Just sit under there and be done with it. Otherwise, you know, you got staples, you got furring strips, boards, you've got stakes in the ground. You know, but by the time you put all that up, it takes you 2 or 3 hours per house to get it all set up. Well, by that time, you've got 3 days of training under your belt in an hour at evening. Are you with me? Yeah. Good question. Yeah. So that's how we train. It carries its own feed. This is 1,000 pounds of feed we carry out on the front. And the whole idea here, again, is to reduce chore time. Dad used to say, you cannot spend more than 4 hours a day on chores. If you're spending more than 4 hours a day on chores, chores are something that has to be done every single day. If you're spending more than 4 hours a day on chores, you'll burn out. You've got to have time in between to recuperate, read, build new things. You've got to recharge your battery, so you can't be doing chores all the time. So carrying our own feed means that we only have to actually come out here with a feed buggy and do that about once every 3 weeks. Well, see, then that's not a chore anymore. Yeah, that's just something that has to be done once every 3 weeks. That completely changes it. Yes, ma'am.
So what is your grain? What is it composed of?
Corn? The grain is corn, whole roasted soybeans, oats, feeding limestone, Fertrel poultry NutriBalancer from Fertrel, and I think that's about it.
From who?
from Fertrell, F-E-R-T-R-E-L-L, Fertrell. That's where we get all of our supplements from. And I'm sure they have dealers somewhere around in the area. There was a question. Somebody else had a question? No. Okay. All right, we're good. Now, just so you don't miss it, the water is, let's see if this pointer will work. Yeah. Okay. This is a, wow, it's even flashing now. How about that? This is one of those garden hose reels, you know, like you mount on the side of your house. And so that's what we mount up there. But most of the hose, we use air hose, 3/8-inch air hose. And you can put about 450 feet of air hose on one of these built for 100 feet of garden hose. It's way cheaper. And chickens aren't like cows. They don't eat, you know, they don't go in there and just slurp up water. So this is the water. Whoops, I'm sorry. This is the water pan right here. One of those indestructible, you know, rubber buckets with a little float valve in the edge of it. Okay. So this here, this end, is going to go out here and hook up to the water line somewhere. And you got a bunch of air hose on that reel and hooked into this garden hose that comes out and hooks onto the little float valve in there. So that's the water, okay? Very, very simple. Feeders inside, obviously you can have any kind of feeders. These are some real old feeders that we got from some neighbors. These are 100-pound feeders. And just, you know, you got to keep the chickens out of them. The floor is slatted. And if you'll notice, there's a poultry netting on top of the floor. The poultry netting keeps possums and raccoons from being able to reach up through those slats and grab a leg. All right? The reason that we have slats is so that we can walk on the floor. If you just had poultry netting, the chickens could walk on it. You know, it'd get a little saggy between the joists, but that's okay. But it'd be very hard for us to walk on it. We'd be, if we stepped off a joist, we'd be stepping out on the netting. Next thing you know, we'd be ripping things and tearing the netting. So the slats are essentially for us, and the chickens can grip them when they sleep in there and roost. All right. Notice another thing, the nest boxes are closed up. When we gather eggs at 4 o'clock in the evening, we flip up these perch boards. If there's one thing that I see the most common, you know, egg problem on farms that I go and visit, it's these perch boards are not being put up to lock the chickens out, so the chickens are staying in the nest boxes at night, and everywhere a chicken sleeps, she leaves a calling card, her manure, which then makes the eggs dirty the next day. If you're having to clean more than 10% of your eggs, there's something wrong with the management. Okay? So this keeps the nest boxes clean. There's another shot of it in the field. Of course, that's... you shut the door in the evening after they go in. And there are now, you know, for a couple, $300 now, you can get a little timer activated, you know, things that close the door. I ran into one guy, he said, spoke at a conference, he says, "I want to thank you for making me the best deer hunter in the county." I said, "Oh, how's that?" He said, "Well, I was too lazy to go out and close my eggmobile up, so he took a disc off of a disc, a heavy metal disc, and hung it to a trigger on this thing that if he hit that disc with a high-powered rifle, it would knock the trigger out and the door would fall down. He didn't have to go out there. So, of course, the eggmobile got farther and farther away from the house, you know. He said, I can hit a deer from 1,000 yards, you know, with that thing. So he became a sharpshooter, not wanting to walk out in the field and close the eggmobile. So it takes all kinds. You never know. Yes, ma'am. Yes, the chickens are actually sleeping on the floor. Chickens actually don't need a roost. You know, you have to train them. I mean, about 30% of them will naturally want a roost, and a lot of them just very happy to sleep on the floor. So I don't see that as a humane thing necessarily. I think it's a lot more important to have a nest that she can make and move around. I don't use roll-away nest boxes. She wants to go in there and make a little nest and move straw around and get situated and all set up, and to have her sitting on an inclined plane and where she can't do anything, I don't know, but that's one of the things. We gather in these regular plastic-coated wire baskets. Notice here, see, gathering eggs. As we gather, we put up the perch boards in the front to lock the chickens out. Now, this is a pair of egg mobiles at one of our leased farms, one of our rental farms. This farm here has a lot of little bridges. It's the best watered farm. It's got water everywhere, little creeks and stuff all over. So they got little bridges around, which couldn't take our wide and small gates. And so these are 8 feet wide and 16 feet long, big enough for 250 apiece. So that's only 500 layers in this particular setting. But it's the same deal. Very, very cute eggmobiles. Ready to come in with the day's gathering. We put away eggs. Basically, we come in then with the baskets and we sort. We put the clean ones directly into the cartons with no washing whatsoever. And then we have a basket of dirties. So we're just putting the dirties in another basket. Those then go into a lukewarm bucket of water, and then we just wash those individually with a little cloth. And then those go into a plastic flat that has holes in the bottom, so that over the next 24 hours they can dry off and drip dry. Tomorrow, yesterday's washed eggs will be the first ones we put away. Then that opens up the little plastic flats with holes in the bottom for then today's washed eggs. Okay, so the washed eggs are always 24 hours behind. Aesthetically and aromatically, sensually romantic. All right, those are the old hoop structures. That's the old feather net, which is now obsolete, in my opinion. I'll leave it in, though, just because it's pretty and just to show you the versatility of whatever kind of structure you can have. The problem with the hoop structure, it's extremely cheap, lightweight, it's easy. The problem with it, though, is that it doesn't have enough structural integrity to use the vertical space for perches and roosts and things. So you're limited to what's on the ground, which means the chickens sleep on the ground. The nest boxes can be hung inside, but you basically have one tier, one level, even though you have this hoop structure. Now there are two kinds of netting. There's one with a post with two spikes with an offset you can push in. And then there's the kind with the one spike. The biggest issue dealing with this netting material is tangles. Tangles coming from piercing. Just see here. Here's the spike end. That's the ground end. Here's the top end. All right. You notice how we're picking it up here. You pick it up kind of an accordion like, and then you can carry it like this. All right. Here's all the stakes. Well, the tangle comes when you accidentally get one of the squares over the end of that spike. Well, the offset ones, which are touted as now you've got, they're more stable, you've got two, and you can push them in the ground and all this stuff. The problem is you've now doubled the amount of spikes that can stick in the squares and get tangled. And so having used the two different kinds, we are absolutely committed to the single spike kind. It reduces your tangles dramatically. So here we are now putting out a new one. So you just go along and you just let them come right off one after another and just lay them on the ground like, flat like a table, and then go back and stick them in the ground. So we're getting ready to move now. So we completely erect a contiguous circle next to the circle where they are, and then we'll go back and open up at a strategic opening of both of them, a waste, if you will, that the chickens can then walk through into the next. But that way you don't have them all getting out who knows where. They're always contained even when they're being moved. You come along and put them in. There again, see, as you're moving along, see this little gather of material. See, you're pulling it tight from over here. There's a whole skill set in how to set this stuff up, you know, so that it's tight and not saggy. But you can see right here, this little gather right here as he's coming our way. Well, again, if you have two prongs here, it's going to be a lot easier to accidentally hook that gather than with only one prong. Now we've got the two set up. Now he's opening the waist. There you go. So opens the new one and then opens the old one, and now those chickens can come right into the new new paddock. Can you back?
Excuse.
Problem with hard ground? Yes, you can, but that's why you just have to work on getting it soft. I mean, hard ground is not. All of us should be committed to making our ground not hard, and not hard comes from carbon, from tilth. Again, notice the chains here. These chains are going back to the hoop structures. Okay, that is a feed sled, and you've got feed racks here. You've got to have enough linear feeder. This is another thing that chicken people don't watch up as carefully, I think, as we need to, and that is enough linear feeder space so that timid birds don't get rooted back. You know, we don't say peck order for nothing. Chickens are, I mean, if one happens to die, those of you who've had chickens, you know, I mean, cows, if one dies, the herd goes off and it, you know, whatever, the coyotes eat it or whatever. But if a chicken dies, they don't go around and have a memorial service, you know. They just eat her up, all right? Same as pigs, all right? That's why when I tell my, you know, people that come to the farm and they want to get into a great big thing, argument with us about, you know, eating animals, and haven't we gotten beyond that now? You know, aren't we, haven't we moved past eating sentient beings, and you got all this kind of stuff? I say, look, get over it. Everything's eating and being eaten. And if you don't believe it, go lie in your flower bed naked for 3 days and see what gets eaten. Everything's eating and being eaten. Okay? So get over that deal. If you've seen any of the electron microscope pictures from Elaine Ingham or Dick Richardson, Dick and Pat Richardson in Texas, they're just amazing. They do electron microscope videos of soil microbial activity. It makes Steven Spielberg look like child's play. I mean, you know, you got the, you know, you watch it and here, you know, into the frame, you know, waddles this big, you know, fat something or other, and then all of a sudden coming in from the edge, you know, is some, you know, six-legged, you know, with a long prong on his snout, and he stabs the, you know, that you know, big fat thing, and you know, and you see juice fly all over, and he sucks it out, you know, and then while that thing's in the throe of convulsing death, you know, here comes another one from another piece of the frame running in, you know, with pincers, and he comes in and whacks his head off, you know, and then it is the most dramatic. It is unbelievable. It will change your life about the soil. It will change your. It's unbelievable. It's more. I mean, it's riveting. It's absolutely riveting. And it's completely, you know, there's no dance instructors or anything. It's all choreographed, just who knows, you know, cosmic whatever. So that's what goes on. All right. So enough feeder space that where I was going with this was so that the chickens can get to it and the timid ones don't get rooted back. Okay. Because the peck order is very, very real. So that's why you got to have enough linear feeder space.
What is the recommended linear space?
The recommended linear space, well, obviously, the bigger a chicken gets, the more linear space you need. But in my opinion, at least 60% of the chickens need to be able to get around it at one time. The nest box ratio is 1 to 10. One nest box to 10 layers. Okay, because you're not going to get 100% production. You're only going to get 70% production. So 7 in 10 layers is going to lay, which means theoretically you could have, each nest would have 7 eggs in it, right? Of course, theory is always just that, theory. What you're going to have is you're going to have some boxes with 10 or 12 and some with 2 or 3. But 1 to 10 is enough. Yes? That's a great question. The question is breed of bird. Wow, I'm going to stop on that one for a minute because it brings up an issue. We use non-hybrids, Rhode Island Reds, Black Astralorps, and Barred Rocks, Barred Plymouth Rocks. That's what we've always used. Our problem is there aren't enough Black Astralorps left in the country to get the volume that we need. So when we order 3,000 Black Astralorp pullets from a hatchery, it takes them like 6 months to get them to us because there aren't enough, some of these rare non-hybrid breeds. The other thing that's happening is that, especially on the Rhode Island Reds and the Barred Rocks, they're being interbred with leghorns in order to increase the egg production and downsize the body. So the body size is getting smaller. Well, what this hybridizing does is, so these are called production reds. You'll see DeKalb Goldens, Cherry Eggers, J.J. Warren Cross. I mean, almost all, especially of the Rhode Island Reds, if it says production reds, that means it's been crossed with a leghorn, and in order to increase the egg production and reduce the body size. The problem is several things. One is that makes a stupider chicken, and a chicken needs all the brain she needs. If you've ever seen the size of a brain in a chicken, she needs all the brain she can get. And secondly, they're much more fragile, and they're more flighty. And in this netting, we need a heavy-bodied bird that's too heavy to fly. We don't want light, heavily winged birds that can fly easily because they can get out of the netting. So we want a, you know, a sumo bird that can't jump as high, that's just not as agile, and a bird that's less fragile. You know, because obviously our number one variable here is weather. You know, extra hot, extra cold, cold rain, just, you know, weather incidents, events. And so we need a really hardy bird. So what's happened, so we're really struggling with trying to find enough of the non-hyped up genetics to get 3,000 pullets at a time. It turns out, and what the hatcheries tell us is that we're overrunning the entire breeding stock of the entire nation. And I'm realizing just how fragile some of these genetic stocks are. You know, American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, if you're familiar with ALBC and some of the work that they're doing. And so I really promote, that's why I tell people, don't be satisfied with the production animals. Ask for the non-production animals to get the old style. So like the batch, we're getting a batch of 2,000 this fall. All we were able to get was 1,000 Rhode Island Reds. They're coming out of Texas. And 1,000 New Hampshire Reds that are not hyped up. It's a problem. And so just everybody that gets chickens, just press your hatchery and keep asking. I don't want production. I don't want the narrow-bodied, little, light, fragile production animals. The chickens that we get, they don't lay as well. But here's the main reason that we want those heavy breeds is because they don't lay as well. You say, good, what's the matter with you? Don't you want them to lay? No, because those other birds lay so well that they actually cannibalize their skeleton to keep up with the calcium drain on their bodies, keep up with the eggshells. Now, to me, and I've never seen a study on this, but to me it just makes sense that an animal that's so productive it's cannibalizing its own skeletal structure cannot pack as much nutritive punch in its package as an animal that's laying less and not cannibalizing its own body structure. Kind of like a high-producing dairy cow, you know, that's producing so much milk, she starts sucking all of her calcium out of her skeleton and then goes into hip dysplasia and whatever. Yes?
Brown.
That's hard for me to believe. I mean, they are egg-laying machines. That's why the industry uses them. That's hard for me to believe. But I would say this, that in our kind of production model, that may be true simply because the heavy breed bird is more, they do more for themselves. You know, they're better hunters. They go out and find more bugs. They don't hang around the feeder. You know, they're more aggressive. Now, what I would like to see, if you want an opportunity, somebody with your ears on that likes genetics and chicks and hatching and stuff like that, what we need to do is to develop an eggmobile genetic. You know, we've had birds that are, I mean, if you put 800 birds in these eggmobiles, there are some that are unbelievably smart. Uncannily smart. They're the first ones to see a hawk coming. They're just survivors, and they're also better grazers. You can gather 100 eggs, and there will be eggs that are just orange yolks that you know those birds have been out. They've been out working. They've been out, you know, picking up for themselves. And then there are eggs that are light yolked. Well, those chickens, they've just been in hanging around. They're welfare parasite chickens. They've just been hanging in around the feeder, all right? And so what we need is somebody that will take this project and start saving the genetics of these survivors, do-it-yourself, aggressive, you know, birds. And I'll tell you what, in 3 or 4 years, I mean, as fast as you can run chicken cycles, because chickens, you know, you can run cycles a lot faster than, for example, cows that have a much longer. With chickens, you could run, you know, maybe 8 generations in 3 or 4 years, and you would absolutely, there's no question in my mind, you would have a chicken that is much less prone to predation, much sharper, you know, and much more aggressive at going out and finding their food. That's where we need to head with this. But we need enough critical mass of people with eggmobiles in the country to create a demand for it.
We found that with our regular laying hens, which that's a great start, which I think our Rhode Island
bred lingered
crop.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Good layers.
Yep.
But then we started hatching them out. We crossed them with a buff.
Okay, you did some hatching yourself. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. With a buff Orpington?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, real heavy birds.
100.
How about that? Neat. Yeah. Good for you. Yeah. I am absolutely convinced that if you did that over a couple more generations, you're going to... We had two chickens one year that didn't come back to the eggmobile. Normally, when that happens, within a week, you see a pile of feathers in the field. You know, if you don't make a point to go out at night, find out where they are, you know, catch them. And sometimes, you know, if they run off in a bunch of woods, you know, edge of a field, it's hard to find them. I mean, they're hunkered down under something. You just can't find them. But what you do find is a pile of feathers in about a week. We had two one season that laid every day and lived the entire summer, never going back to the eggmobile, and nothing ever caught them. And we said, boy, if we could take those two birds, see, that's what we're talking about. If you could get those two birds and cross them over and select those, you know, maybe we'd have, the comic Pinky and the Brain. You know, maybe Pinky and the Brain. Maybe we'd have the brain chickens, you know, going to take over the world. Yes?
That's what I'm doing with the Buck Orpingtons and the Colombian Wyandottes.
Okay.
And I had a Colombian Wyandotte, which I didn't know was missing, because I can't count
them first. Uh-huh. Huh, so she was, yeah.
So we've been crossing those all summer long. We've had chickens sitting on eggs.
Huh.
And
wonderful.
Marking mother and babies. So when we do the culling, those won't get culled because they have a chance.
Right. No, that's wonderful. And you're letting them set on their own eggs and hatch them out themselves. Wonderful. That's the kind of stuff you can do when you're small. That's one of our problems now, is that we've gotten to a scale that makes that very, very difficult to do for us. That's reasonable. So that's great. I'm glad that that's being done, and we just need to do more and more and more of that. Yeah. Okay. Deep cycle battery and an energizer. We use a little 3-foot ground rod and just pound it in. And one interesting thing is that wildlife is much more squeamish about electricity than domestic livestock. It's almost like, you know, the domestic livestock builds up kind of, you know, memory over, you know, being used to stock. In fact, I think we've used electric fence now for so many decades. I think our calves are actually born already knowing about electric fence. But wildlife is very, very squeamish about it. Okay, here's the new feather net. Again, you can see the fence going around. This is a quarter acre. These are 350-foot pieces with 1,000 layers. Here's the feed buggy right ahead of it. That's just an axle. Hook onto it with a tractor, and it's just chained then back to the skids over here. You can see the chickens eating from the feeders. Very simple construction. Here's your 3-inch pipe skids down here with an angle iron ear welded onto it to receive this truss here. This is a scissor truss right here, and then you have a rafter coming up here, and so you have your triangulation. It's extremely strong. We routinely have tours, you know, people. I mean, we have thousands of visitors at the farm, and routinely this whole catwalk up in here will be shoulder to shoulder full of people, and it doesn't give a lick. I mean, it's just strong beyond anything. Yes?
What type of wind do you have?
Wind? 80 miles an hour. That's another advantage of this. It's way, way heavier than the little hoop structures, and it is not as prone to blow over. Yeah. Much, much stronger that way. Again, you see the nest boxes are strung up on the edges. This is the catwalk. This is just a slatted catwalk down the center. And the chickens, you see all these perch boards out here on the edges so they can sleep there. Again, this the whole idea here, there's several advantages. Now I'm going to back up here. Okay, one of the big advantages here is with the hoop structures. Because of a hoop structure wants to sag, so you have to tie the two bottom ends together or it'll splay out. Are you with me? Does that make sense? All right. So what you have on the hoop structures is you have something connecting these bottoms right across here that can trip up and snag the chickens as you move it. The beauty of this is that all of the structure, you've got these two skids, but there's nothing going across here next to the ground. So you can move this on the hoop structures. You know, we would routinely, you know, kill a chicken every couple, three moves. You snag one accidentally. Here, we never snag one because they can all pop under this bottom X brace. Are you with me? Really, that was a huge reason to change the design. Okay, this is a big hoop. This one's 30 feet by 48 feet long, 30 by 48. And what we have learned is that's a little too big. We pushed it and pushed it and just to push the envelope. And for us, that's a little too big. It's a little bit cumbersome. Amazing size, but just a little cumbersome. These here?
Oh, the crisscross.
That one is 20 by 32 at the eaves. The skids are 16 by 32. And then the eaves come out 2 feet on each side beyond the skids. So the actual footprint, the actual what's on the ground is 16 by 32. Yeah, and that's big enough easily for 1,000 birds. Easily. Yeah. All right, so these are the old hoops on the feather net, and these were 20 by 20 chained together. So you see, these are 20 by 20. That's 400 plus 400. That's 800 square feet, whereas the other is 32 by 20, which is only 640 square feet, and the birds have more room in that than they did in this. The other thing is that by having all those perch boards up the scissor trusses, it spreads the birds out, so if it's an inclement weather situation, they don't pile up and suffocate. Once in a while, you get a suffocation thing in here if you happen to have a real, real cold, blowy rain or something, and they'd get, you know, chilled and cold, and they'd, whereas with the other, they never do. Lots of reasons. Okay, wintertime. These are hoop structures. These are stationary hoop structures. You've got poultry netting. Poultry netting going up 4 feet on the inside so the chickens can't peck and scratch the netting. I mean the plastic. All right. Deep bedding. So there's side boards that come up 18 inches to handle this deep bedding here. There are the nest boxes. See the same deal. Pigs. Rabbits. The pigs work fine as long as the pigs are under 75 pounds. When the pigs get over 75 pounds, they begin getting a hankering for drumsticks for dinner. So timing is everything. And then vegetables. Boy, I can't tell you the number of vegetables that we're growing in these. We've got even peanuts. We ate sweet corn before the end of June, planting sweet corn. And then corn loves the nitrogen in this bedding. So sweet corn's just fabulous. And squash, melons, tomatoes seem to do the best. But, yeah, it's good. Turkeys in a vineyard. Again, turkeys. Here's the thing with turkeys. We brood the turkeys with the chicks. And I know that violates every rule you'll ever see in every poultry book. Never commingle turkeys and chicks, right? Well, we tried and tried and tried to adhere to that for a long time, and we just finally kind of gave up on turkey poults, because if you've ever raised turkeys, the thing about turkey poults is that they have one goal in mind when they hatch: how to think up a new way to die. They're extremely creative at figuring out how to die. And so we were about to give up on turkeys, they were just hard. Until Daniel married Sherry. See, the problem with daughters-in-law is that they didn't always grow up doing it this way. So they come with all these newfangled ideas that you have to swallow your pride and say, okay, you know, we'll try it. So when Sherry, after she saw us struggling, and finally she said, well, I didn't know turkeys were a problem until I came here. We just always raised them with chicks. With the chicks. We'd get, you know, some turkeys and chicks, and we just raise them together. So we said, okay, what do we got to lose? So several years ago, we tried to do that, and it worked wonderfully. So we've finagled around with the ratios, and what we've found is that as long as we don't violate one turkey to five chicks, so there are five chick teachers to teach one turkey how to stay alive. So as long as there's a teacher to student ratio of 5 to 1, the turkeys do fabulous. If it's 1 to 4, there aren't enough teachers. It takes a lot of teachers. You know, here's the water. No, that's poop. You don't eat that. Here's the feed over here. That's what you can eat. You know, it's quite a far side deal, but it's real. Believe me, it's real. So what happens is we just give them broiler feed, and the turkeys, they're bigger, of course, from day one, and they essentially muscle the chicks out of the way and eat the protein. They want a 28% protein. The chicks are fine with an 18%, so it's kind of like Jack Spratt and his wife. You know, the turkeys want the protein, the chicks like the starch, and so the turkeys, just because they're top of the, you know, they bull their way in, they get the first pickings at the feeder, and then the chicks clean up the starch, and they both work fine. Again, it's a 1 to 5 ratio. So then at 3 weeks, the turkeys, little turkey poults, come out with the broilers into the field shelters. But at 7 weeks, the turkeys get bigger than the broilers and start beating up on them. So then at 7 weeks, we pull the turkeys out of the broiler shelters, and they go into the netting. At that point, the turkey is big enough to not go through the holes, because the thing about the turkeys is they never learn about this electrified netting. They never get it. I mean, even fully grown 16-week-old turkeys, grasshopper comes by outside the electrified netting. They stick their head out through the hole. And you can watch them. You know, they're jerking. And they, you know, they get their, you know, grasshopper, and then they kind of look around, you know, you know, and then they gradually pull their head in. They never get it. They never understand. And so the trick with the turkeys, to teach them with, in fact, Premier Catalog, they will say the only species they don't recommend the netting for is turkeys. But here's what we found, that if we expose the turkeys early enough to the netting, that it is a physical barrier, then they respect it even when they get big enough to walk over it. Once a turkey gets pretty big, you know, 11, 12 weeks old, they're big enough, well, they can just walk up there and just bowl it over. They just walk right over it and can keep on going. So the key is exposure early enough that they physically can't bowl it over. It is a physical barrier until they learn that there is a boundary to their life. No, they don't fly out. Yes? These are regular industrial NASCAR race car high-octane double-breasted turkeys. Yeah. And I'm waiting for the follow-up question. Yes? The layers are the hybrid I'm talking about, not the meat chickens or the turkeys. Yes, that's right. Waiting for somebody to bring up heritage breeds. Nobody's going to bring it up. Why not heritage breeds? All right, she bit on the bait. Okay. Okay. I am very much a friend of American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, and certainly my whole thing about the chickens, I hope everybody appreciates. I am all about the older breeds. However, I'm also not interested in altruism to the point that I go bankrupt as a farmer. Here's the problem. When you go to heritage breeds, they grow way slower. They're much harder to control. It's all dark meat. You can argue whether it tastes better or not, but it doesn't have a double breast. And it's got to be very, very expensive because they grow for so long, are much tougher to process. Often they're twice as old and way smaller and with a razor breast. Now, in marketing, you know, people actually like you to be a little bit weird, you know, to have a different product. They like it. But they will only let you be so weird. Society will only let you be so weird before they start, oh, you know, he's off the deep end. You know, you can be a Buddhist and you can be a nudist. But if you're a nudist Buddhist, that's too weird. So here we are, we're telling people, you have to cook this chicken, it's not pre-cooked. Yeah, that's a big deal. You've got to get a whole chicken. That's a big deal. You know, 50 years ago, I'll be very sexist, 30 years ago, you couldn't go to the supermarket and buy boneless, skinless breast. 30 years ago, every woman that bought one of our chickens knew how to cut up a chicken. Today, half of them don't even know a chicken has bones. I'm serious. I mean, if it's not boneless, skinless, I don't know what it is. You know, I got news for you. You know, extruded, amalgamated, reconstituted, glued together chicken McNuggets in the form of Dino's the dinosaur is not a muscle group on a chicken. So what happens is that when we tell people, not only do you have to get a whole bird, you've got to cook it yourself. It's not going to have a pop-up baster in it, you know, all that stuff. You've got to come to the farm and get it. You can't get it at Costco or Walmart, okay? Or, you know, you've got to get in your car and do something different. You've got to order it online or, you know, you got to do something besides that. And then you tell them not only that, but it's going to be all dark meat with a razor breast and cost twice as much and tougher. You've just become a nudist Buddhist. And so we are still using. Now, that doesn't mean we're experimenting. This year, for the first time, we've done 2 400 bird batches of Freedom Rangers on the for the broilers. This is the La Belle Rouge genetics from France, the French broiler. It's a hybrid between the old style chicken and the broilers that we use in America. It's a kind of a it's a little double breasted, grows slower than our typical broiler, but not razor breasted. Has a little more white meat, and they finally, over 3 years, were able to import the genetics. J&M Hatchery in Massachusetts, Connecticut, is offering them for the first time, and seem to be a middle of the road deal. And of course, you know, here in this country, they're offering them as the Freedom Ranger, you know, like Freedom Fries instead of French fries. So, how long does this session go?
We got about 15 minutes.
About 15 minutes. Woo. Okay. So we're doing those, and the jury's out on whether we're going to continue. But all our feedback so far has been very, very positive. They've been enough double-breasted that they're acceptable, but not so bad that they're unacceptable. So my deal with the heritage breeds is I like them, but I would rather have a product that everybody can buy that is 95%, let's agree, 95% perfect, than a product that's perfect that only 5% of the people can buy. I know that can get me hot water, but I'd like to dislocate all the Smithfield pig factories and Tyson chicken houses. I think that'd be a great thing, okay? And we're not going to do it with razor-breasted heritage breeds that can't be fast-cooked and have no white meat. Sorry, it ain't going to happen. You know, because in persuasion, you can't move people. If you've got a scale of 1 to 10, a 1 is a McDonald's junkie, and a 10 is a, you know, I got my own garden and my own milk cow and my own flour grinder in the kitchen and, you know, scratch everything. You don't move a 1 to a 10 overnight. You got to move a 1 to a 2, a 2 to a 3, all right? It's incremental changes. All right. This is the racking house with your chickens on the bottom and the rabbits up above. This is extremely intensive and profitable. It's very, very profitable. Okay, go through the rabbits here real quick.
Who's buying your rabbits?
Who's buying our rabbits? People that like rabbit. It's a very ethnic market: British, French, Italian. A few Orientals, but primarily Italian, French, a lot of restaurants. If we had enough of them right now, we could sell 500 a week if we had them. And we charge $6 a pound, so they average 2 3/4 pound as 12-week-old fryers, which is about $15 a rabbit. And so if we could sell 500 a week, that would be $7,500 a week. Is that right? Times 50 weeks is like $40,000 a year. $400,000 a year, I mean. There's enough there. You know, the rabbit market is not huge, but nobody's doing it. So even though it's a very small item, if you're the only game in town. Even though maybe in Virginia there's only a sale of 2 million rabbits a year, but if we're the only game in town, 2 million is enough to have a very successful business. So, you know, that's the deal. Yes.
What kind of rabbits do you sell?
What kind of rabbits? Furry rabbits.
Oh.
Oh, well, there are meat rabbit genetics. Now, what I was pointing out earlier was this is where I want to go. I mean, what Daniel's done with his rabbits of this nativized genetics. Basically, a swope forage-based rabbit, okay? That's where I want to go with a lot of these things. As opposed to heritage breeds, what we need to be doing is taking the same kind of mentality that over centuries selected the Dorsets and the Yorkshires and the Scottish Highlanders in the old country because it was the right physiology and phenotype for that climatic condition, to take that same selection process now to us and do line breeding and regional selection to where over time our legacy is a new line of climatized, regionalized, physiological, phenotypical genetics for our grandchildren called nativized genetics. Okay? That's what we're looking for. All right. Yes? Oh, the beauty of rabbits is they're not an agricultural commodity.
Oh, they aren't?
No. The chickens were under the public law 9492 producer-grower exemption that allows us to do 20,000 birds a year, okay? But the rabbits, now we can't put them in a retail store for resale, but end user, no regulations. Even to restaurants, because a restaurant is an end user. Institution, retail, hotel, those are all end user. In other words, end user is where it's going to come out of there in somebody's stomach. We couldn't sell it to, what's your grocery store around here?
Safeway.
Safeway. Okay. We couldn't sell it to Safeway, but we could sell it to Safeway's deli. See? Because nothing more is going to be done to it than that place of retail sale.
Now, this is the federal law?
Yeah. Oh. Federal. Mm-hmm. Federal, yeah, USDA. Okay, this is our Taj Mahal brooder house again with the chicks. You notice the these are broken up into 1,000 bird compartments, so they're not all at the same. This reduces the stress. My own totally non-scientific, experiential, intuitive formula for stress is density times mass times time. All three of those factors play in. Density, mass, and time. You can crowd things up pretty tightly if there aren't very many of them. And you can crowd things up pretty tightly for a day, but only a day. Okay? And so there are all those factors. So the breaking up reduces the mass. So they're not all 3,000 of them together. They're spread out in 1,000 bird groups. These nipple waterers are just amazing, very clean, just tremendous. And the chicks do find them. You know, those chicks, they don't have to spend any time filling out IRS paperwork, finding insurance, or, you know, getting zoning regulation permits. And in 2 minutes, they find these waterers. Deep bedding, this is essentially a concrete cake pan here with 20-inch concrete sill plates to accommodate deep bedding up to almost 2 feet deep. The whole idea, if you're going to have animals in a housing situation, is to have the bedding deep enough to have a strata of community of nematodes and biologicals living in there. If I told you to go out and build a 12-inch by 12-inch by 12-inch compost pile, if you know anything about compost piles, you would tell me that can't be done. Why can't you build a 1 foot by 1 foot by 1 foot compost pile? Not enough mass, thank you. Yes, not enough mass to maintain a core community. It's got to be like 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, okay? Minimal size. Same thing with deep bedding. You can't have a healthy biological sanitary community life if it's only going to be 2 or 3 inches. It's got to be at least like 8 to 12 inches before you get enough distance away from the top and the bottom to have a core community of biological life that keeps the bad bugs in check. The idea here is not sterilization. It is a community. It is a habitat that rewards the good bugs more than the bad bugs, so that the good bugs keep the bad bugs in check. That then creates a very living bedding that gives the chicks a lot to do, and their scratching then oxygenates it to again feed the soil, feed the bedding microbial life. You can water it. You can water it. What we do is under those nipples, nipple waterers, that's where the most active life is. But yes, you can put in garden sprinklers, absolutely, and sprinkle it. We do aerate it between batches, which is with a potato fork. Just go in and, you know, with a light, I mean, it stays pretty light. But yes, a sprinkler to water it so that it stimulates it is great. Yes. The bedding needs to be a friable bedding, not straw, hay. It needs to be something that the particles are fluffy enough and small enough that the chicks can move them around. So we like sawdust or wood shavings the best. Even wood chips are too big, but something real light and friable and fuzzy. Ground up corn cobs would work. Even peat moss works, but we don't recommend it because it's so dusty that it can go up and burn your house down. Okay, so here we are catching them at 3 weeks to go out, or somewhere in the second week. We just take crates, you can kind of see, make a simple corral there, and then just start picking them up and put them into crates. Out to the field we go. There's the first day out in the field. That's pretty vulnerable. That's why we use completely enclosed shelters. I can't believe the number of Humane Society people that think this is inhumane, that those chicks should be allowed to run free. Those chicks run free, they're not going to last 24 hours, trust me. Even crows and starlings would pick them up. So these are 10 foot by 12 foot by 2 foot high shelters. We stagger them through the field so that we can run the trailing one right next to the other one. Otherwise, you'd have to leave a space between them to get access. Then you'd have a zebra stripe field. Okay? So this allows us to run them right adjacent. Little dolly here. We make these dollies in the shop. Very simple. You just stick them under, and it breaks the ground contact enough. See, it just rides up enough to break the ground, and the chickens then are just walking to the next spot.
How often do you move them?
Every single morning. Once a day. Every single morning. First thing in the morning, daybreak. That's when chickens are most active, and the forage is the tenderest because it's gone through the night's dewy crisper. Okay? And that all of this is to stimulate the ingestion of green material. That's why the timing, we mow it with the cows ahead of the chickens to shorten the grass down so that the chickens can masticate the forage. Okay? So it's not long and hard to eat. Tender. Okay? 8 weeks. The waterers, again, these are industry waterers. Gravity, these are just low pressure waterers. Just a 5 gallon bucket on the top with a rubber hose stuck through it. Just gravity feeds in. We dip and carry. Notice the dip bucket. So we're not dipping from the buckets that we carry. The reason we don't do that is because the buckets we carry obviously are going to be set down. They're going to be set down on places that the chickens have just vacated on their manure. So we don't want to be dredging through the clean water with the buckets that we've carried and set in the chicken manure. All right? This is just common sense. This isn't, you know, chlorination or anything. It's just common sense. You want to be as hygienic as possible. Feed. Okay, turkeys. Now, this is at 7 weeks, all right? The turkeys have just gone out into the netting. Now, if you have trouble with the turkeys going through the netting, if they're a little bit small, then what we do, obviously when the turkeys first go out, they're real small and don't need as big a circle, maybe just one netting, then we'll take another netting and put it right against it so we have two nettings and the holes crisscross, all right? So you have a double netting. Only takes 5 to 10 days, you know, maybe, you know, 2 5-day stays, and then they're big enough and one netting is fine. The turkeys, unlike the chickens, about the most that they will eat, graze on grass, is up to 10% of their ration, of their diet. It's not that much. It's a supplemental type of thing. An important supplement, but a supplemental thing. The turkeys, they'll eat up to 40% of their diet. So actually the difference between supermarket chickens and our chickens is not as pronounced as it is supermarket turkeys and our turkeys. Because anything that will eat grass, the more grass it will eat, the more difference there is between ours and the industry, because the industry doesn't want to feed grass anything except beef cattle, and you know, even beef cattle, of course, eat grass most of their lives, even in an industrial setting. Very, very simple. This is just aluminum conduit bent onto a very light wooden frame to provide shelter. Once the turkeys get to about 8 weeks, they actually don't need an impermeable shelter. They can do with just a shade cloth because they can get wet and they'll be just fine. This is on a hay wagon chassis. Look at the perch boards. There's that preacher again. Okay, we'll quit there. Any other questions? Yes.
How do you base your prices?
How do we base our pricing structure? Okay, what we do is on all these things, we go back to our labor. Essentially, what we're selling is our time in this. And so when we're looking at margins, what we want is to get paid. We've kind of set a benchmark of $20 an hour that we want for our time. I mean, if we don't get $20 an hour, you might as well go punch a time clock for somebody else, all right? If you're going to want the headaches of being an entrepreneur, you need to be well compensated. And so we set $20 to $25 an hour as a benchmark. So we know that it takes us X number of minutes. So obviously, on the, for example, the broilers, the chick's going to cost us, let's just say, 90 cents. The feed is going to be 12 pounds at 25 cents. That's $3. Then we're going to have 10 cents in propane, depreciation, you know, amortization of all the stuff. So you're going to have at least $4, and if you want to be real generous, $4.50 in a bird, okay? And those birds are going to average over 4 pounds dressed. We're going to have roughly 5 person minutes per bird, which means that we can raise 12 birds per hour, 12 birds per person hour, okay? I said that wrong. It's 5 birds. We have about 10 birds. I'm sorry, 10 minutes, 10 person minutes. There's actually an equal amount of time in production. If you add up, if you prorate all the production time and then the processing time, those are equal. Roughly equal. That shows you where the money is. The money and all these things is in the value added end of it, in the processing. Getting it in a package that all the consumers want to eat, okay? And so at 10 minutes, that means we can do 6 birds per person minute, per person hour. And so if we've got $4.50 in actual cost, expense, we have a 4-plus-pound carcass. If we want to get $20 an hour, we're going to need to get $3.50 net per bird, which means we need to be up there at the $8 per bird level, which $8 divided by 4 pounds is $2 a pound. Now we're charging $3 a pound to restaurants, $3.25 to individuals. Is our price right now, which gives us a nice cushion. You know, it gives us a nice margin. Because one of the things that we're dealing with is the third part of that is marketing. And marketing is just about the same need as the production, the processing, and the marketing. Those are the three parts of that retail income. That's where the other piece. So we're now with our growers, former interns and apprentices taking these other farms, we're paying them $2.50 a pound, and we're selling them for $3, which gives us $2 for marketing, gives them still their nice $20 an hour return, okay, to labor. Excuse me?
How about turkeys?
Turkeys, okay. Turkeys are exactly the same price as the broilers, and it comes out right about the same. Because on the turkeys, interestingly enough, we have more time in production, but the processing is twice as efficient because it's Duplos instead of Legos. You can't go you can't go quite as fast with the turkeys, obviously, but you don't go a third as fast. But you have three times the weight in the bird. So turkey is priced the same way, but the allocation of the expenses is a little different. So the turkey's the same price. Yeah.
One more
question? Who hasn't asked one? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, ma'am. Of our, excuse me?
Your
the guard dog is an Akbash Anatolian Shepherd cross. That's Turkish. It's a Turkish dog. Akbash?
Yeah.
I don't know. Does somebody know? I think it's Turkish. It's like A-K-B-A-S-H or something.
But wouldn't your Great Pyrenees be just as good?
Great Pyrenees is fine. Okay. I don't care. In fact, I talked to a guy in Pennsylvania. He was having a terrible predation problems on his eggmobiles. So he made a little portable, on a little Red Flyer hay wagon chassis, a little dog kennel that he hooked to the back end of his last Eggmobile. And he made a little cell feeder that the chickens couldn't get in, but only the dog could get in. And the dog stays there with the Eggmobiles, and he's never had another predator since. And it's just a mongrel. It's just a mutt that he picked up. Who knows? So I think a lot of it is just the canine presence, to create that canine presence that keeps the predators away. I don't think it's as much the breed or the size or all that, as much as it's just predators move into a vacuum. They always move into a vacuum. And so it's just trying to deal with not having a vacuum that makes it possible. Okay, great. I'll look forward to visiting with you more this afternoon. Wonderful questions, and I hope it was beneficial for you. Thank you.